Our first case for argument this morning is United States against Rowan. Mr. Deddy.
Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, Patrick Deddy on behalf of the appellant in this case, Mr. Rowan. For purposes of this appeal, Mr. Rowan does not dispute that while he was the CEO or president of the management company of Edgewater Hospital, the hospital had illegal financial arrangements with three different doctors, Dr. Barnabas, Dr. Cabrilla, and Dr. Rao. And we do not contest that the government's evidence established that these particular agreements and contracts with these doctors, one of whom, Dr. Barnabas, was an internist, Dr. Cabrilla was a cardiologist, and Dr. Rao was an anesthesiologist, all were illegal referral arrangements in violation of the anti-kickback statute and the START II statute. And it is the government's contention in this case that because of these illegal referral arrangements, the hospital's annual cost reports for the years 1995 through 2000 contained false certifications. That is, that Mr. Rogan, or at his direction, those cost reports were submitted, but that the certifications that the hospital was in compliance with all the rules and regulations of the Medicare program were true. And that is the nature of the false omission, if you will, that is the basis for the government's theory for a False Claims Act charge against Mr. Rogan. Just so the record is clear, the illegal arrangements or a stipulation in this particular case that there was no other allegation with respect to any medically unnecessary procedures. It was strictly the question of these were all, for purposes of Mr. Rogan's trial, the claims submitted on behalf of the hospital with respect to these were all legitimate medically necessary procedures that were paid by Medicare in the regular course of the hospital's submission.
Mr. Deddy, there's something I want to try and understand, because for me it may be a key, and it's this. It seems, reading the statutes, that the government has a statutory duty not to pay these claims.
With respect to the Stark Law, Stark II.
Right.
That's correct.
So that your argument seems to be, however, that the government still has to present evidence that it would have followed that law, that it would have followed the law. So I guess my bottom line question is, why can't the district court presume that the government must follow its statutory obligations purely as a matter of law?
Well, Judge, I guess the reason is that you have to look at, I think, in context of this particular case. 1995 was the first year in which the Stark statute was enacted. During the period of time of this particular scheme, Stark was amended two times, one in 1997 through 1999, and again in 1999 through, I think, 2001. At the same time, the regulations that were promulgated with respect to Stark II were not actually issued until 1998. And so it is not as simple as the government would have you believe that there was automatically going to be necessarily by the CMS or its predecessor HCFA a determination by the government that they would not have paid all of these claims. And I think the other thing that you have to keep in mind, this is not a linear progression.
I'm lost, counsel. Okay. Since the statute forbids the payment of these claims, why doesn't one say that representations about this subject are material? We all know big bureaucracies have trouble. They can't turn on a dime. They don't always follow the law, any more than the police catch all speeders. But it seems very difficult to say that a representation isn't even material just because you're predicting that the bureaucracy won't be able to enforce the law.
Well, the problem, Your Honor, I think, is that in this particular case, you're talking about what would CMS have done when it got this cost reports with respect to the interim payments that were made during, for instance, 1995, it gets a cost report filed in May of 1996 for all the hospital's claims, both ones involving the doctors, in this case Dr. Cabrera and Dr. Barnabas, and also all the other hospital claims. And so the question is, first of all, how would have I think it's too simple to say they would have denied or not paid every claim that has the name of Dr. Cabrera and Dr. Barnabas in it somewhere, because as the district court found, what Stark makes illegal is the referral of for services to the hospital. So there's nothing in the record for the court to determine how it is that CMS would have determined which of these patients were referred to the hospital because of the illegal referral arrangement. And that's really the crux of the case on appeal here. The problem is that there isn't any affirmative evidence from the government's representatives in any capacity, unlike if you direct your attention to the Thompson case, which is cited by all the parties, where they had a representative from CMS who testified, and again, that was on a summary judgment case, that they would not have paid these claims and denied these claims, but that was a simple case.
That's where you lose me, and perhaps you're losing Judge Grosvenor too. The statute forbids payment.
But right? The question,
you don't need to get a bureaucrat on the stand to say it is the policy of our agency to follow the law. It is required to follow the law.
But the question is, which of the claims, of the thousands of claims that were submitted by the hospital in this case, were claims in which would be prohibited?
See, and as simplistic as it may seem, it seems to me that what you have to explain is how did that change? How did that change? In other words, didn't the government always have a duty not to pay these types of claims, or suddenly, when you had this change in the law, did that occur? So you see, that's the disconnect.
In 1995, the Stark II statute made illegal referrals that are part of the case in this case, subject to either denial of payment, which is one of the provisions of the Stark statute, the government could seek a refund for payments previously made, or, and again, the question, with all due respect for the court about the bureaucracy, they could have chosen to assess civil penalties for these false claims, or they could have sought exclusion of either the doctors or the hospital. So there's a multiple number of things that the government could have done in response to what in this case were interim payments that were already made. And there's no evidence in the record in this case how the government would have gone about either recouping or seeking refunds for those claims, and which of the claims involving these doctors it would have sought to get.
But the law still was, I take it, that there was a statutory duty not to pay the claims.
Well, the statutory duty, Your Honor, runs to the question of the claims that were referred to the hospital, that is, the patients referred to the hospital for procedures by the physicians who were engaged in the illegal referral arrangement. And the trouble with the government's proof in this case is they never specifically identified which of the patients who were treated at Edgewater Hospital were actually illegally referred by these physicians during the period in question. There was a lot of testimony about the fact that these doctors, two of them testified, that they understood that they were supposed to refer patients to the hospital, but there's nothing in the record to indicate which of the 1,812 specific claims that are subject to the calculations by the district court. There's nothing in the court to indicate that these are specific cases in which these specific doctors referred these patients to the hospital. In fact, I think, and if you wanted me to get to the damages calculation, it may be easier to understand in that context, but I was saving that for later in the argument, but you have to understand that with respect to what the hospital records or the submissions by the hospital showed with respect to the 1,812 interim payments that were made was that Dr. Cabrera or Dr. Barnes were either the attending physician or the operating physician. And a number of these cases, For instance, there's about 765 cases out of the 1,800 in which Dr. Cabrilla, as a cardiologist, performed some operation and his name was on the UB92 form, and yet he was not the attending physician. Dr. Barnabas was not the attending physician. So those particular claims, we would suggest to the court, there's no evidence in the record to indicate that those patients were referred to the hospital by either Dr. Cabrilla, Dr. Barnabas, or Dr. Rao.
So these are not claims that those doctors pled guilty to.
There was no evidence in the record. They pled guilty to a scheme, a mail fraud and a healthcare fraud scheme, and there was testimony that they were, in fact, engaged in that scheme. But the problem was there's no evidence in the record of either the hospital's record, internal records or the claim submitted to the government. For instance, there's nothing in the government form that identifies the referring physician. There's nothing in the government's form that you submit for Medicare payments that there's even the admitting physician is on necessarily the UB92 form, which were the subject for these 1,812 claims. So,
did the three doctors plead guilty to before and after the flux in the law?
They pled guilty to the period of time in the law. But again, they did not plead guilty in this case. They were charged in a separate indictment.
No, I understand that.
But I think that you have to understand that with respect to the claims themselves, there's no nexus between the illegal referral arrangement and these particular claims. And I guess that's the point I would like to stress to the court.
Was there any specificity with regard to the criminal the crimes they admitted to?
They admitted to mail fraud and I think Section 1347, which is
mail fraud. By what?
By submitting these, by engaging in a scheme to defraud by use of the mails, which involved submitting, some of the documents were actually submitted by mail. For instance, the cost reports were submitted. But the false claims that were subject to the complaint against Mr. Rogan and some of these other individual entities, they were all related to the specific UB92 claims that were submitted electronically to the government and the cost reports that were submitted by mail. And that is the subject, that is the problem with the proof, is that there's nothing in the record to establish that, in fact, these particular claims were claims that the doctor or the patients that the doctors actually referred. Unless there's some other questions, I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Bondi.
May it please the court, my name is Thomas Bondi. I represent the appellee, excuse me, the United States.
Could I know this is cruel to stop you immediately, but if you could help me here. What I'd appreciate is if you could respond to this idea that the regulations governing which claims the government would pay were in flux during the relevant time, because the argument, as I'm hearing it, seems to be that there were some claims that the government would have paid under the evolving regulations, let us say, these sort of in flux regulations, even if the claims were tainted by violation of, the Stark law, the anti-kickback law.
Yes, Your Honor. Nothing in the district court's decision in this case or in the government's position rests in any part on any regulations or on any change in regulations. From day one in this case, the statute, the legislative enactment promulgated by Congress, had a no-pay commandment. Thou shalt not pay.
In other words, it doesn't matter that there was flux going on, or are you contending there was no flux going on?
There was no flux. What there was on January 1, 1995, the Stark Law in its current form came into being. And as always happens when new legislation is enacted, the agency did not get around to promulgating regulations pursuant to that statute for a number of years thereafter. But none of that matters.
See, it seems to me that presumably, certainly, surely, some of these patients had real medical needs. And they would have been treated at some other hospital if they hadn't been treated at Edgewater. How can then the government have suffered actual damages for those patients if it would have paid claims for them, in any case, to a different provider? Or are you saying these were all well people who were coming in and having procedures that were totally unnecessary?
The whole point here is that due to Rogan's egregious misconduct, there's no way to know. All of the medical care performed at Edgewater with respect to every patient with respect to whom either Kubria or Barnabas was the attending or operating physician in that universe, all of the medical treatment is irretrievably and irrevocably tainted because the doctors were being paid under the table to churn medical treatment.
And
so
yet,
we don't know. It's all tainted.
And yet Mr. Rogan was never criminally charged.
Your Honor, he wasn't criminally charged, but the district court found in this case, after a trial, in factual findings that are not disputed here, that Rogan conspired with all of the people who were criminally charged and convicted, and that he was, in fact, a central participant, if not the central participant in the whole fraud scheme. But, again, to go back to your question, Your Honor.
So the U.S. Attorney's Office was bamboozled?
Your Honor, let me just be direct. If you're asking me why Mr. Rogan was not criminally charged, I mean, the short answer for me is I don't know. But maybe we know now things we didn't know then. The indictment decisions were made in a time frame roughly 7 years ago. I mean, what we know now, in large part due to the civil trial that happened in this case that's before you, is that Rogan was at the very center of all of this misconduct, and none of that is disputed. And, Your Honor, if I could go back to your question, the important thing about the Stark and the anti-kickback statutes, and this really is critical, is they are extremely broad prophylactic provisions. And what they say is that if a physician is receiving an improper payment from a hospital, there's three huge prophylactic bans. The physician can't refer any patient to that hospital for any designated health services. That's a ban that's directed at the doctors. That's number one. Number two, a ban that's directed at the hospitals. The hospital can't bill anyone, any person, any insurance, the federal government, anyone, for any such service. That's number two. And then the kicker is ban number three, which is directed at Medicare, and it tells Medicare, thou shalt not pay. You cannot pay. This is the strongest possible case for a materiality analysis under the False Claims Act. There's no mystery here. There's no analysis to be done. There are no facts to be put on. The statute says, thou shalt not pay. You cannot pay. All of this is just tainted and infected from the outset, because there's no way to reconstruct whether any of the doctors, with respect to any of the relevant hospital items here, were exercising untainted independent medical judgment, or whether they were acting on the basis of the bribes and under the table payments they received. They couldn't even know. How do you know when you're getting paid to churn medical items and services for a hospital? You don't even know whether you're exercising your independent medical judgment. So the $16.8 million that the government paid out on these claims, all of it is damages, every single penny, because what the government was paying for was medical items and services that were provided pursuant to untainted independent medical judgment. It didn't get that. It got $16.8 million worth of hospital services that were all infected by tainted medical judgment because the doctors involved were receiving bribes under the table.
What proof, when the doctors pled guilty, what was the proof that you tendered to the court?
Your Honor, in the criminal case?
Yes.
Well, they pled guilty, and the guilty pleas contain pages and pages of admissions by the criminal defendants. So let me recite to you what that is. Let me make clear at the outset, what they pled guilty to was awful. I mean, it was absolutely awful. Dr. Kubria pled guilty to performing hundreds of invasive heart procedures on people who didn't need them. He opened them up and did things to their hearts that they didn't need. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and two of them died. That's in the guilty plea.
Okay, well then, I mean, that's the answer to the question that I asked you.
Now, there it is, Your Honor. And Barnabas pled guilty.
In other words, if they had been medically necessary, it still wouldn't have mattered.
Of course not. But one of the things...
If they'd been, you know, if Yemen efforts, these people were saved, you know, the good Lord himself couldn't have done better. They still... That's what you're saying.
Yes, and that's what the Stark Law says as a matter of law. But if I could flesh that out, Your Honor, just to repeat, you can't unring the bell now. Imagine if we held a trial now to try to get into the details of the medical care provided to every patient involved in this case. There's no way to figure out whether a particular blood test was ordered. Just a trivial thing like that. And that's the kind of thing that was involved in the bills here. Was the blood test ordered because the patient needed a blood test? Or was the blood test ordered because the doctor who ordered it was getting paid thousands and thousands of dollars to churn medical bills for the hospital? Even if the doctor was standing here right now before you, how would he know? Once you're infected, once you're receiving bribes for churning bills for hospitals, even you don't know whether you're exercising independent medical judgment. Having said that, the idea that this is a pure, clean case, that we know that nothing was done that was medically, you know, bad, which I think my opposing counsel tried to suggest to you, that's ridiculous. I mean, that's just absurd. Dr. Kubria here and Dr. Barnabas admitted in guilty pleas that are matters of public record, you can pull them up on your computers, to the most awful kinds of conduct by doctors. Kubria especially admitted, and this is all there, I'm not making this up, performing hundreds of invasive heart procedures that were not necessary, and two of those patients died. That's what he pled guilty to. And one way of impressing this upon Your Honor is imagine what it takes to get a doctor to plead guilty without even contesting the charges to a criminal plea that takes his license away and puts him in jail for 12 years. That's what Kubria pled guilty to. I mean, you got to imagine what he knew the case was against them. And frankly, I think there were potential homicide charges or even felony murder charges lurking in the background that were part of that calculation. Dr. Barnabas pled guilty to just generating hospitalizations that weren't necessary. What he would do is hospitalize people who didn't need to be hospitalized. He pled guilty to that. Then when they were in the hospital, you order blood tests, you order x-rays, you keep them in the hospital for X nights, and it's the hospital charges that are the basis for the false claims here. It's not the physician services. So things like room and board, nights in the hospital, blood tests, x-rays, over and over and over and over again. That's what adds up to $16.8 million here. And the government paid out $16.8 million, and it got nothing in return. Nothing, not one penny, because there's no way to show that what it got was any clean, proper, unbiased medical judgment. There's no way to show that. We couldn't have showed it if we tried. The Stark Law stands for the proposition that we don't have to try. It's just a broad, prophylactic provision that puts an umbrella of taint over everything that any of these doctors did at this hospital if they were the referring physician, which, by the way, they were, because what we did is carefully call out of the database of Medicare and Medicaid provisions here every patient stay for which either Kubria or Barnabas was the attending or the operating physician. They were the responsible doctors. And by the way, the way we got this data in large part was thanks to the good work of Mr. Rogan, who was extremely keen to make sure his bribes were giving him what he wanted to, and he kept meticulous records of who he was bribing and for how much and which patients it covered. That's in large part how the relevant database of patients and numbers was arrived at here. The wrongdoer here who was paying bribes paid great care and attention to whether he was getting what he wanted to in return for the bribes. But I just want to stress, in terms of the issues here, materiality and would the government have paid, you know, False Claims Act cases arise, as your honors know, in a huge variety of contexts under a huge variety of statutes and regulations, it's literally almost impossible to imagine a stronger case for materiality and for the other limited issues that are before you here today than this case. It's hard to imagine a stronger case. And I also wanted to stress, as please keep in mind what my opposing counsel started with today. I mean, this case begins, from the appellant's point of view, with huge concessions. I mean, there are elaborate fact findings here. None of them are contested on appeal. There's really only very limited liability and damages issues before you today, and all of them founder on the same basic point. And it's this notion that Congress, not a regulation that was in flux, but Congress passed an absolute ban, a huge prophylactic direct ban on this kind of activity.
How does the operating and attending relate to the referring physician?
Let me make clear, the term referral in this context isn't a colloquial term. It's a statutorily defined term. It's defined in the Stark Act. And if you're the attending physician or the operating physician, you fall within that definition. Remember, the attending physician, and this really is simple, if you're the attending physician, you're the physician in charge. So, of course, what we look to when constructing the database of relevant claims for purpose of this case, we look to cases where Barnabas or Kubria was the doctor in charge. It's the attending physician that the Medicare forms require you to put on the form. Of course they do. That's the one who matters. He's the one with the actual responsibility. So if, say, Barnabas was the attending physician, he's responsible for that patient's stay in the hospital. That's what it means, and that's how it means in common parlance, and that's actually what it means as defined in the Stark Law. And the same would apply vis-a-vis Kubria and these heart procedures he performed over and over again. He's the one performing the procedure. I mean.
Now, of course, Mr. Deedy maintains that the Stark Law was in flux. You maintain it was not. There were no changes whatsoever from 91 on.
No, Your Honor. You just said 91. The Stark Law, as is pertinent for this case, came into being on January 1, 1995. That's the version that's relevant. And everything in this case, in terms of the claims, the damages, all the activity in this case, all of it
is post.
January 1995, post. So I want to make that clear. There was an earlier version
right,
of the Stark Law.
I know.
The one we're talking about is January 1, 1995, going forward. And any regs after that don't matter. And there was no, you know, flux in the regs, but it doesn't matter. The statute says what it says. It's hard to imagine it saying any more clearly, thou shalt not pay. And it says to the doctors, thou shalt not refer. It says to the hospitals, thou shalt not bill. And it says to Medicare, thou shalt not pay. It really says that. I mean, it's hard to imagine a stronger case for materiality and for any of the other issues. Your Honors, I see that my red light is on. Unless the court has any further questions, the government has nothing more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Thank Bondi. You. Anything further, Mr. Titi?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
First of all, let me just briefly respond to Mr. Bondi's claim that somehow the criminal charges against the doctors are somehow relevant in this case. The plea agreements were introduced merely to show, for purposes of impeachment of the credibility of these particular witnesses. They were not offered against Mr. Rogan. There are, and I cited on page, I think the first page of my reply brief, that the entire recitation or claim somehow that this was all about medically unnecessary charges is just something the district court took out of the equation at the trial. The government conceded that they were not going to attempt to prove that Mr. Rogan had any idea that these doctors were performing medically unnecessary procedures. The only basis for the false claims charge against Mr. Rogan was that he had been engaged in this illegal financial arrangement with these doctors to refer patients to the hospital.
Am I wrong in believing that it was Mr. Rogan who successfully requested the exclusion of the evidence regarding
they moved to exclude it. There was a motion eliminate that was granted. I can provide it to the court if you don't find it in the record after the argument today, but the record is clear that particular issue was not before the district court, and the government did not seek to prove that there was any of these particular 1,812 interim payments were the basis of some medically unnecessary charge.
But are you now arguing that what was requested by the defense to be excluded is now relevant?
No, I'm only responding to the argument by the government that somehow the fact that these defendants pled guilty to criminal charges should somehow determine how the False Claims Act provisions with respect to this case are applied. And again, there's no dispute that these doctors referred patients. The dispute we have with respect to the calculation of damages is the way the government went about claiming that these particular charges were actually patients referred by these physicians. That's just not the evidence, and nothing that the government offered in its case in chief established that these particular 1,812 claims were for patients referred by either Dr. Cabrillo, Dr. Barnabas, or Dr. Rao. And it's for that reason that there was no actual proof that the government would not have paid these particular charges. There's no dispute that some of those charges probably fell within the category, but there were other ones we would contend, Your Honor. I see my time is up. But our position is that there, the 1,812 charges contained any number of patients who were not referred by Dr. Cabrillo or Dr. Barnabas.
In other words, they came in through the emergency room, they came in through other doctors,
That's correct.
Walked in the door.
There were approximately 765 of the 1,800 that were referred by other physicians. There were 590 that came in through either the ER, another skilled nursing facility, or in some cases another hospital.
Were these doctors the attending or operating physicians in those cases?
Not in all those cases. In some of the cases, for instance, Dr. Cabrillo was just the operating physician on 765 patients who were not referred by Dr. Barnabas or him. So there were 765 of the claims that were used to calculate it that were not referred, or there's no evidence of how they were referred, but they clearly were not the attending physician or the admitting physician, which there is no record that they were in any of these cases. So that's the problem with the calculation, is that there's no nexus between the illegal referrals and the payments ultimately made by the government.
So is it your view that the case needs to be remanded for a case-by-case study of who was and who wasn't?
I believe the matter should be remanded for determination with respect to the calculation of damages as to whether or not these particular claims were submitted for patients illegally referred by the two doctors. That would be our position with respect to the damages component.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.